If you have a broken guitar, don't fret. Take the scenic drive to Fort Atkinson to Jeff's Guitar Clinic. We'll have you fretting your guitar in no time at all. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, we love guitars.
Welcome to another podcast. It's sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Let's start out with another great clip, since we haven't talked for a few days, of Rick Wilson, political consultant and Trump connoisseur.
Look, every president benefits from having a strong, effective chief of staff. Reince Priebus is a nice man, a good administrator in some ways, but he is not adult supervision for this man-baby president. He is not able to say to Trump, stop tweeting, shut up, read your speeches, go to these events, do these things, make these calls, stop having 47 people rush in and out of your office and change your mind on things every 30 seconds. You know, there's a lot of talk about whether Reince Priebus will leave or stay. The question is, would you even notice at this point? This is a president who manages himself.
Right.
He is not managed by a chief of staff, and every president needs one. It's an iron law of Washington.
Boy, what a compliment to our friend Ryan. Who would notice? Isn't that what you and I have been saying since, like, January?
I think it was. I think he actually said one more thing here.
Okay. Got it.
Tonight, a message.
I must have cut the man. Did I play the man baby part? Because he called Trump a man baby.
Well, no. What you just played was them saying.
Yeah. About Reince Priebus. Yeah. Well, he called him a man baby.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true. I think that's a demonstrable fact.
Well, now he's a man baby who likes playing with toys in his crib.
Yep. Yeah. You mean like big bombs?
Mothers of all bombs, which is Moab. I don't think the community of Moab, Utah really likes being...
I can't. Well, they didn't. I don't think they voted for him. I may be wrong. But, does anybody know the irony of where the term mother of all kind of came into the American parlance?
Mother of all? Where did it come into...
Mother of all battles.
Oh, mother of all battles. Sure. Yeah.
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 I mean, I never heard that. Did you ever hear that phrase before, Son of Armistead? Mother of all battles?
I have heard that term, now that you mention it.
Yeah, so why is... I'm like, whose idea was that? To call that the mother of all bombs? I mean, where did that come from?
Well, isn't it remarkable that they used it at this moment?
I think it is. No, unfortunately, I'm not sure it is. And, you know, we have this very interesting thing going on right now where we've gotten to the... I didn't think we could get to a worse stage of just paying attention to Trump than of just paying attention to Trump. But they've actually... Our media has actually discovered something worse. Palace intrigues within the Trump White House. And it's like, is Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs more influential today than Steve Bannon? Right? And the problem with that is that then creates a circumstance where we start to tell ourselves that somehow we'd be a lot better off if a guy from Goldman Sachs was running things than if a guy from Breitbart was running.
Well, that's right.
It's not that much
better. And you know, I think one of the reasons that the media's gotten sidetracked off on that is because we don't have a president who's a fully formed adult. And doesn't have a political ideology, doesn't read, everyone talks about him being so influenced by the last person in the room. So we try to read the tea leaves by finding out who he's listening to at any given moment.
Right. And you know what it turns out the biggest news story of the last month was?
I don't know. Sean Spicer thinking that concentration camps are called Holocaust centers?
That's the most horrifying.
Okay.
Up of the last month. Biggest news story, something that actually we should have recognized us more than anything else, but we didn't quite recognize it, or at least most of us didn't, when Ivanka moved her office into the White House. So Ivanka Trump, first daughter, moves her office into the White House. She locates in a shared office with a woman who's come into the administration from Goldman Sachs. woman she locates with gets a promotion and given a whole bunch of different responsibilities, and within like right around the same time.
Uh-huh.
And then a week or so later, they're like, yeah, Gary Cohn, this guy from Goldman Sachs, he's kind of running things now. And what I will suggest to you is that Donald Trump does listen to the last person who talked to him. When his daughter, who I genuinely believe he likes and trusts, moves into the White House, and she clearly picks a camp, right? She joins a side. I think that's, again, I'm falling into the palace intrigue trap. That'll be the biggest news of the last month.
Well, that is very true. Let us play a little, and which would explain why suddenly China is no longer a currency devaluator, huh?
Well, do you know, like, the like about 300 million times most popular Trump person in, you know, Trump person is in China? Trump-associated person?
Who's that?
Ivanka.
Oh, Ivanka. They well, she makes it. Some of her, she makes some of her items over in China.
Not in China's too high, high pay. That, but,
Vietnam, yeah.
Yeah, but no, no. You don't know about this? This is like this is a subtlety of following Trumpism. So Ivanka's daughter is like five or six, and she's in immersive Chinese study.
Oh.
And so they made videos of her singing Chinese holiday songs.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
Those are among the most watched videos in China.
Other than the United Airlines flight.
Well, that's always a pleasure.
That's become a big hit in China.
No, but I will tell you, this is a big deal. And clearly, Ivanka errs. There's a lot of evidence to say, I shouldn't say that for sure, but she errs toward China. And so isn't that interesting? She moves into the White House. The people she starts hanging out with are suddenly empowered, and we're suddenly got different attitudes toward currency.
You know, I'm not hearing much about renegotiating NAFTA or getting tough with China on trade anymore. Are you?
I will tell you, as we said during the campaign, that was the biggest bait and switch. I mean, that was just a flat-out lie he was telling people. And, you know, see, you know what the problem was? And this is, again, something you were saying. I think we both were saying it back during the campaign. The guy clearly knows nothing about trade. Not a thing. He doesn't have the baseline information. He doesn't have the baseline information that somebody who read a bumper sticker has, right? And so, you know, he just said, oh, this is popular. People cheer when I say I'm going to do this. Now he's in there and breaking the free trade regimen, this sort of semi-religion that, you know, pro-free traders have, is unbelievably hard to do in D.C. And you know what happens if you don't do it? Suddenly, all sorts of people that were harshly critical of you start saying, you know, he's starting to seem presidential.
Yeah, right. That's Trump. Right.
That's a reward.
Okay, so the upper Midwest, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, almost Minnesota, people always forget about that, go for Trump in a presidential election. So what does the Midwest get for it? Slashed health care and Medicaid. 100% cut to Great Lakes Cleanup Fund. 100%.
Uh-huh. I know.
And not lifting a finger, really, on free trade other than some bluster and threatening specific countries.
Yeah.
That just doesn't... And now he's threatening to cut off more people off health care and threatening Democrats if they don't cut a deal on health care. That doesn't seem like a very good trade-off.
And wait.
More?
I promise you. Wait until the farm policies start to come down.
Oh.
You really think those are going to be good?
No. How about the tax policy?
Small farms? Man. Follow right on through, brother. And so my only counsel is that at the end of the day, Donald Trump will be the most anti-rural and most anti-upper Midwest president in generations. And one hopes that those who are not Trump fans figure out how to talk about that.
Ooh.
Because the simple reality is we ought to have an incredible whipsaw coming off this thing as people realize what's been done, you know, how bad this guy is.
Well, I think that is up to us in some respects. This is just honestly one of my favorite clips of all time.
We had finished dinner. We're now having dessert. And we had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake that you've ever seen. And President Xi was enjoying it. So what happens is, I said, we've just launched 59 missiles heading to Iraq.
Well, you headed to Syria.
Yes, heading toward Syria. And I want you to know that.
Sitting in a lavish resort in Florida, bragging about eating expensive, fancy cake with a Chinese dictator. Man, here's a guy that finally got middle America. Here's a guy who understood how to speak to lumberjacks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And coal miners.
I know. Yeah, that just doesn't sound very populist to me.
Well, here's the other deal, too. Everybody said, it's going to be interesting when Trump actually figures out that he's president, all the stuff he can do.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Because I don't think he thought much about it. And you know what the biggest, the scariest, most awful thing that he realized? He could sit around with the leaders of the countries he used to criticize, right? And he gets the entire elite media of the country compliments him for doing that. And if he then sends off stacks of bombs, right, and starts bombing other places, cable news goes wall to wall saying he's presidential.
Well, here
and
is...
So I think he's starting to discover the power of the presidency. The problem is, he's discovering every wrong power of the president.
Well, you want to hear something frightening. Here is retired, was he a general, Jack Jacobs? Here he is complimenting Trump's verbiage last night on Brian Williams' show.
Well, one of the things he's learned is to delegate responsibility and decision-making. I mean, he's distancing himself from the micromanagement that took place in the previous administration, and I think he was involved in it at the very beginning. He doesn't want to do it. And he sent the decision-making down to the field commanders, and that's where the decision was made. And I agree that he didn't even know about it until we knew about it, which is just fine. He is perfectly happy to say his military. And I'm reminded of Lyndon Johnson's observation when the Marine said, here's your helicopter. He says, son, they're all my helicopters. And I think he feels the same way as long as it does what it needs to do.
Does it bother you to hear a president call it my military?
No, not at all, because at the end of the day, it really... Look, if he thinks it's his, it's perfectly okay for it to be his. At the end of the day, the buck does stop with him. He can make things happen or not make them happen. And I think I'm happy for him to do that, too, because he's getting closer and closer to the adult supervision in the West Wing of the White House, to General McMaster, to General Mattis. The closer he gets to them, I think the happier I'll be that he calls it his military.
Then why did we have an election? Why didn't we just do a military coup?
Why did you just put a general in charge?
Yeah.
I mean, look, one of the reasons Trump got elected, and remember, this is the important thing to understand here, and always to be repeated, Trump didn't win the popular vote. He lost by 3 million. He won narrowly in a handful of states, Wisconsin, 22,000. Michigan, something around 11, stuff like that.
It was close in Florida.
Yeah, all over. So the narrowest of margins got him elected. And I would argue, without a doubt, that one of the things that got him elected was a sense that he was very skeptical about military adventurism, that he ripped into Bush for doing Iraq, that he ripped into a lot of other people for being too inclined to, go off starting wars. And clearly... that was a message that he sent again and again in the Republican primary process and even into the November election. And for these TV commentators to say, they come on and say, well, yeah, Donald Trump, he didn't seem presidential or he didn't seem adult till now. He's doing one of the one things that he said he wouldn't do, right? And I find it very dangerous. I also, look, I know everybody's supposed to like General Mattis and McMaster. You know, this country used to have a real tradition of civilian control of the country.
Uh-huh.
And that doesn't mean that McMaster and Mattis are bad leaders. I actually think they're both kind of real intellectuals, military men who also have, some great ability to think, and they really have done it. They've written books. They've thought about stuff. But the problem is, I've read their books. And, you know, one of the things they really believe in is a lot of maximum use of military power. And I would only counsel that when you combine that with Trump's megalomania, you don't end up in a good place.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
We're back with John Nichols at SlysOffice.com, talking a little bit of catching up a little bit. Here is another, I could play Rick Wilson clips just all day. Cause
you're enjoying it.
He is just, yeah, he's just a, and the fact that he's a Republican is really kind of funny. He's not a progressive, great player or anything. He's just
no,
dead.
No, he doesn't do it politically.
No. But yeah, he is funnier than hell, and he sees right through Trump, and it's great. Here's more.
Your reaction to Eric Trump today saying what I think Trumps have been dying to say since the missiles were fired. This proves Dad doesn't have any real connection to Vladimir Putin because he just fired missiles at Vladimir Putin's client, President Assad.
Look, if I wanted advice on hair gel, I'll call Eric Trump. This is a guy who knows absolutely nothing about anything in this world. He knows nothing about the relationships of his dad with the Russians, except in sort of a tangential way. He doesn't understand the geopolitics of this and what the three or four different layers of that could explain this would be. So I sort of write off things that Eric Trump has to say. He's, you know, he's the less bright of an unbright crowd. So Eric's defense of his dad is a pretty weak. It's pretty weak sauce.
But isn't he speaking for Trump supporters and Trump followers there
who are
looking for the proof that Donald Trump is not influenced by Vladimir Putin? Those missiles will now be their proof.
They're looking for any thin reed to hold on to. They're looking for anything to deny and spin away from the fact that the emerging picture never gets better for them about Russia. It always gets worse.
And it is getting worse. The Guardian had quite a story the other day. It is getting worse, and yet now we have a relationship with Russia that, at least on the surface, is disintegrating. Although I don't know how much of it is acting
sly,
out.
Sly. First off, you're losing the first message of the first rule of radio. I should not have to explain this to you. You don't just let an Eric Trump moment pass. Go into the substantive.
Well, come on, that was a great Eric Trump clip.
That's what I mean. You got to dig into that and give that the hair gel thing. That was a winning line. Did you see the Saturday Night Live thing where the Trump boys come on and explain how independent they are?
Uh-huh.
I mean, with the juice box and stuff. But here's the interesting thing. I have a question for you.
Where did I screw up here?
Well, because you went, so you got became so substantive and thoughtful.
Oh.
You got a little too intellectual
right
away and let the Eric Trump moment pass. So now I'm going to give you a substantive question. You give me the answer. Okay? And where you go, I'm going to respect. Do you think before we landed at Normandy that the Allies called the Axis folks and said, yeah, we're going to be landing on Normandy. You want to get your people out of the way?
No. I at the end of that, my question for you, I said, I'm not sure if this is all being acted out. It seems a little suspicious to me.
Well, they called the Russians and said, you know, hey, we're gonna be messing with this airfield, you know, just to let you know. So I know people want to imagine that now we've gone to this like kind of high stakes oppositional stance, but didn't Tillerson just go to Russia and say, yeah, you know, like he's basically. We're working with everybody, you know, everybody's working here. We're all kind of putting things together. And so I don't see as much of a break in relations, right, as some of these folks seem to see.
Well,
now, I
you
realize
know, there is
the factors are different. The circumstances are different, but
the ridiculously inept Secretary of State, who's nothing more than a figurehead job now, he did put out an incredible statement about the Ukraine. And he said the American taxpayers don't care about Ukraine. And I thought, Ukraine is strategically a very important country for both the NATO forces and obviously Russia. But more importantly, the United States over the years has invested a fair amount of money in keeping Putin out of Kiev and ruling it like it's a state of the old Soviet Union. It's right. a very important country.
Similarly, yes, of course.
It's also the breadbasket for much. It's also the breadbasket for much of Europe.
Right, and we staked a lot of our foreign policy on that. And now, you know, we get these different signals. And also Tillerson, you know, right after the bombing in Syria, right? After the bombing in Syria, Tillerson's going, well, yeah, you know, we're still kind of in the same relations. It's just we had to, you know, let them know who's boss as regards chemical weapons, which, by the way, I agree with. You know, I mean, I at least agree that we should be really strongly against chemical weapons. But what I'm saying is, if you look back on, you know, the history of countries with which the U.S. has had poor relations, right? Be it in fully militarized moments, time of war, but even in Cold War, and even in, you know, basically circumstances where we might have relations with a country, but it's not on the best of terms. You know, as best I can tell, we generally try to keep things secret, right? You don't give them, like, the heads up. Now, I understand the dynamics of the heads up. I respect it, that we don't want to get to, you know, we don't suddenly have something happen and have it degenerate into nuclear war or something like that. I do understand all of the geopolitics of this. And so I'm not criticizing Trump for giving the Russians the heads up about the bombing of that airfield. What I'm saying is, what makes people think that the fact that the bomb was dropped, that those bombs were dropped, that suddenly all of, you know, everything's changed and the relationship is now completely belligerent? I think that's fantasy.
Well, I also,
and I may be wrong,
do we have any idea what the Trump policy is in Syria?
Well, I mean, if you listen to Tillerson, admittedly, I'm not sure what he's in charge of, but if you listen to Tillerson, it sounds like our policy is pretty much what it was.
Let me ask
you. We had this incident last week, but now we're kind of back
right
in the same turf.
Let me change subjects before we're finished today. We can talk about North Korea next time. That's a lot to digest right there. This special election in Kansas Tuesday. I know that district.
Really,
I've been in that district. That is everyone talks about what a deep red district that is. Well, you know, it really wasn't all that long ago that district was represented by a liberal Jewish guy named Dan Glickman, who later became agriculture secretary. Admittedly, it is configured differently now than it was then because of Republican gerrymandering. But this James Thompson, not related to the former governor of Illinois, won a primary, and Democrats decided not to help him. Tom Perez talking about going to every state all over the place. We got to win in places we haven't won before. I'm just livid about the way they blew an opportunity. When you get somebody at this moment up to 46%, these people are saying, well, the Democrats couldn't have pulled him over the line. It only would have hurt him. You know, he needed money. He needed money. He needed to get out the vote effort, and they didn't do it.
Well, look, here's the bottom line on all this thing. We're talking about a lot of geopolitics and global tests and challenges. Let's go down to the basics of it. It seems like the Democratic Party is so embarrassed with itself that they would actually use as their excuse for blowing a potential pickup of a congressional seat at a critical point that, well, we're so unpopular and we're so disliked that if we had stepped up, people would have turned against the guy. And, like, that's probably the worst excuse ever for a political party. But the fundamental reality of it is this. If I followed that race really closely, the Republicans got conscious of that race at the end, really at the close. And what they did was they looked at some polls and they said, you know what? This thing looks bad. It looks like it could really turn on us. So we need to jump in. So what did they do? They sent in hundreds of thousands of dollars, the party and its allies. They got Paul Ryan to send an urgent note telling people to get involved. They got Donald Trump to tweet about it. They got Mike Pence to, I think, make robocalls. They, you know, I mean, they fully stepped up because they said, you know, look, we got a weekend here. We can't let this race slip away from us. What if Democrats had stepped up? What if they had gotten the money in, gotten, you know, maybe, you know, I don't know who they, who, if anybody would have to step up, like, with tweets and things like that, but essentially get the money there. Might they have been able to equal the playing field so that instead of a 7,000-8,000 vote for the Republican, that you come down to a, you know, what it was very possibly going to be, a very close result that the Democrat might have won.
There were two counties the Democrats could have run, the two counties in that district that are Democratic, or at least Sedgwick, which is Wichita. They could have gotten a bigger vote out of there in an urban area. Yeah. And this is the home of Koch Industries.
It is.
It would have been, you know, and it just amazes me. As a matter of fact, I think there's a real chance they're going to lose Georgia next week.
Well,
the Democrats are going to lose that race. And I actually think the Kansas seat, in the end, may have been the more winnable of the two.
Well, that, I hate to say, you might be right about. We don't know. We'll find out. But,
The National Democratic Party feels more comfortable with a Democrat, a former Democratic staffer in a suburban district where he's not screaming populism.
And where the guy who, you know, James Thompson decided to run, he's a civil rights lawyer, he stood strong, and he said he was inspired by Bernie Sanders. And I just don't know that all the D.C. folks thought that was a good model, but the fact is, this guy got himself to 46% in a district where Republicans were winning in the past by over 30%. So he brought it into competitive range. And to not have, you know, that last 250,000 come in for, you know, final radio, TV, you know, mailings, that, you know, just that last weekend, it's, to me, it's stunning. It suggests to me that everything they say about having learned from the 2016 race, I'm not sure they've learned a whole lot.
No. They didn't learn a thing because they continue to have a bunch of wealthy, out-of-touch people support people like Tom Perez. And I think Tom Perez is going to be a disaster. I don't like him. I think he's terrible on message. He's a terrible communicator. And while he may have done some good things as labor secretary, I think he's going to be a disaster.
Yeah. Look, this is my bottom line. I don't think the Democratic Party has yet to learn basic lessons of 2016. And you realize, Sly, if they don't get it right by 2018, if they don't learn this lesson, it doesn't look like things get better from there on out. 2018 is the time to swing this thing and swing it fast. And they should have won that Kansas race. They need to win the Georgia race. They need to win the Montana race. You've got to start piling up wins in places that are hard, because if you're not capitalizing off this resistance and this anger at Trump sufficiently in these races, how are you going to do it in 2018?
John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation at slysoffice.com.
For more wisdom like that, drive home with Sly on the Big AM 1380 and the Big FM 93.7.
You like that?